Welcome. This is a BikeOn podcast. I'm Richard Pater, the director of BikeOn in Israel, here in a sunny Jerusalem. And across in the neighborhood next door, but speaking to me remotely, is Yael Katz, the editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post, probably the leading English language, Israel-orientated Jewish newspaper. Thank you very much indeed for joining me today.
Yeah, my pleasure, Richard.
So if I can start, kind of obviously we're in the midst of this crisis of coronavirus. How do you assess the Israeli government's performance up to now in dealing with the crisis?
Well, I mean, you know, on the one hand, I think that Israel has done a good job in containing the virus. Right, there seems to be a decline in the number of those infected. We're no longer doubling at all. There's a slight increase every single day of maybe just about 100 and change. The death toll is almost at 200, but it hasn't yet crossed 200. The number of those on respirators is declining as well. So overall, it seems that we're doing a good job. And Israel also got its act together quite quickly in terms of getting itself on equipment and respirators. But I have two main flaws that I would point out. The first is in terms of testing. Testing, according to all experts, is really the key here. You talk to anyone. I mean, you listen to Governor Cuomo in New York, he's talking about testing. You listen to the authorities in the UK, they're talking about testing. Everybody's all about testing. And here, for a few weeks in the beginning, there was a lot of fighting about the testing and whether that really was so important. The health ministry seemed to put very early on an emphasis more on the lockdown and the quarantine and less on the testing. But as we now know, we need to be able to test to localize and isolate and pinpoint who's infected and to be able to get those who aren't out to create green zones and red zones. But Israel just can't get the testing right. We finally got up to 12,000 2 days ago. Now they just announced they have problems with some of the swab sticks and they're going to have to redo everything. So it's just been one big mess with the testing. And the second problem, I think, and I say this because on the one hand, I think that Netanyahu has done a good job. On the other hand, I feel like he has hyper-politicized the crisis and used it very much for his political interests. I think that on the one hand, he might not have had a new government, which he just signed the other day with Benny Gantz, had it not been for coronavirus. But I also think that had it not been for coronavirus, he might have also not agreed to sign the deal, because his concern was that if he waited too long, it might hit him back and you know, everything would go backwards. The situation would deteriorate, and then he would pay a political price later on if he would decide to go to a new election. So coronavirus definitely played a very important political role here. We could talk about that later. But I also saw the way he centralized the control of this crisis. He never shared the stage with any other minister. The only two, Richard, if you recall, who ever were on the same stage with him was Yaakov Litzman, the health minister, who's a marginal politician in Israel. And the second one was Moshe Kahlon, the outgoing finance minister, who's no longer in politics. He's gone. He's done. Right. So he only would share a stage with politicians who don't pose a political threat to him. And this is a time when you really need to utilize the entire government. The way he fought with Bennett, the defense minister, Naftali Bennett, instead of using the defense ministry and the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces, from the get-go, I think there just was a lot of these political issues that came up that impaired Israel's ability to do even a better job than the good job it did.
Thank you. Well, listen, as you said, I want to kind of get onto the politics now. That's obviously the biggest, most dramatic news from this week, that finally we have a coalition agreement. If I can start just by asking you, and kind of on the face of it, what do you make of the deal itself?
You know, on the one hand, I can say I'm a big fan of the deal. I have a lot of concerns with the way it looks, with some of the clauses that are in there. For example, the fact that you're going to have 36 ministers, something like 16 deputy ministers, that you're going to have the second residence for whichever of the two, Gantz or Netanyahu, is not serving as prime minister. This is all a huge waste of money. It's a waste of money at a time that there's over a million Israelis who are out of work. There are people slipping below the poverty line. And this is the message our government is sending us. I'm also concerned about some of the clauses in the agreement that give Netanyahu, who, let's not forget, is a prime minister who's under indictment, whose trial is about to begin on severe corruption charges, gives him the ability to veto the appointment of the Inspector General of the Police, the Attorney General, the State's Attorney, the appointment of Supreme Court justices. I think that should be a point of concern. But Richard, as you know well, there was a band back in the 1960s called the Rolling Stones. They had a great song, which I think they recorded in London, which was back in 68, which was says something like, you can't always get what you want, but if you try sometimes, you just might find you get what you need. And I think that Israel needed a government. We needed these 17 months of political stalemate to come to an end, right? This isn't the government I think that any of us really wanted, but it is the government that we need, because I still believe that we need to put this behind us. We need to move on. We need to be able to deal with this crisis as with a stable government in office. We need to pass a state budget, which is something you can't do with interim governments. You need to be able to do strategic planning, forward looking about the economy, about security and defense issues. We need, and not to mention the fact that, as you know as well as I do, the mudslinging that's gone on here, the polarizing reality of having gone through three elections has not been good for the soul of the state of Israel. So it's important that we're able to move beyond that. And I hope that this government will be able to take us there.
Do you share the view? I mean, there are some skeptical analysts, certainly amongst the Israeli media, that see this all as kind of some form of trap, that before Gantz gets his turn, there will be a way for Netanyahu to unravel it and to jump to new elections. And in fact, Benny Gantz will never actually serve as prime minister. Do you share those concerns? Do you think the deal is watertight enough to avoid those tricks?
I mean, 100%. I would not trust Netanyahu, right? And I think that, you know, Gantz has done all he could to ensure that rotation will take place come October 2021. They will be, by the way, this government, which they've signed an initial agreement to establish together, it'll still take weeks till it's actually formed, because they have weeks of legislation that they have to take care of first in the Knesset to pass the laws that would, for Gantz, at least guarantee that rotation will take place. But we all know is that Netanyahu is really a master politician, very cynical, and I would not be surprised at all if he were to find some way to topple the government, go to a new election, when these 18 months are up. It's possible. On the other hand, it's possible that he would abide by it, right? And I think that I have a lot of criticism of Gantz. I think that he may have caved in too much in this agreement. But, and you know, he might have surrendered the leverage that he had in terms of the anti-Netanyahu legislation that was being spoken about being passed in the Knesset now. But like, for example, that someone with an indictment cannot serve as prime minister, passing term limits, things like that. He gave that up too quickly. He broke up blue and white too quickly. But he also is the first person in the last 11 years to put an expiration date on Benjamin Netanyahu's forehead. That's not a small feat. And you're right. It's remains to be seen if that will happen. But for the time being, that itself is a pretty big success. And I think that what we'll see over the next 18 months, at least the first, you know, that's the first period during which Netanyahu is prime minister, Gantz has to, his main objective, his main mission above everything else, is to get himself to sit on that prime ministerial chair, right? And if he can get there, he believes that he can rehabilitate himself and build himself up to be, again, a viable option come the next election. So it remains to be seen, but I agree. I'm very skeptical.
I mean, what do you make? I mean, there was a kind of a public spat between the former partners of Blue and White, of now the head of Yesh Atid, Telem Lapid, coming out with some really biting comments yesterday about kind of the betrayal that he felt to his voters on behalf of kind of Gantz leaving and joining Netanyahu. And it's a fascinating debate between kind of Gantz's position of taking national responsibility in the era of coronavirus and Lapid kind of sticking to the commitments of over a million Israeli voters and standing on an anti-corruption ticket. Where do you think kind of the body of the blue and white supporters kind of feel on that debate? Where's your sense of who has more credibility?
Look, I mean, you know, you saw some of the polling that was done by some of the TV stations here show that an overwhelming majority of Israelis are in favor of this unity government. So I think that itself is telling. On the other hand, we did a poll about a week ago at the Jerusalem Post, which showed that Netanyahu's up to over 40 seats, had approval ratings of over 70%. And at the same time, Gantz is down to 16, 17 seats, right? So the question will really be longer term, right? It's difficult to know now. I think that his voters, a lot of people voted for Gantz because they were disenchanted with Netanyahu and were less voting for Gantz and more voting against the prime minister. On the other hand, if Gantz is really able to remove Netanyahu from the prime minister office, he's able to take and replace him with himself, that could change things, right? So I think it's too early to tell. I think Lapid, for his purposes, did a smart move politically. He needed to break away at some point. He needed to distinguish himself. He needed to try to rebuild himself as a viable prime ministerial candidate because he was, you know, now the shadow or number two of Benny Gantz. This was his move to make that happen. So I wouldn't, you know, read too much into that little fight that seems to be taking place right now between all of them. But the real time to test it will be, like you mentioned before, will that rotation take place? And when the next election comes, how will Gantz look going into it? How will Netanyahu look going into it? There's a lot of still unknown factors. By the way, one of them, for example, right, we know that the agreement is for 3 years, but apparently there's a clause in the agreement that the prime minister can step down. So, like, Netanyahu gets 18 months and Gantz gets 18 months. But Netanyahu could decide, for example, to step down after 16 months. Then Gantz immediately goes in for his 18 months. And after his 18 months, you're still in at the 3 years. You have 2 months left. Netanyahu comes back, and then he's the prime minister for 2 months plus the 90 days of the election, right? So Netanyahu might want to do that because he might want to go into the election as prime minister as opposed to giving Gantz the gift of going into the election as a prime minister. So there's still a lot to wait and see how this all plays out.
That's reminiscent of the 1980s when we had the unity deal between between Shamir's Likud and Shimon Peres' Labour Party, that the idea was, in hindsight, that the person who goes second gets to run the election as the incumbent prime minister with those advantages.
Correct, which has advantages because you're the incumbent. The media is more focused on you. That's definitely a big plus to have.
Understand that Netanyahu will be meeting with his natural partners on the right wing bloc and trying to persuade, I think, primarily Naftali Bennett, who you know very well, whether he can step down from his idea commitment to obviously he's not going to retain the defense ministry, he's not going to get the justice ministry. Will he suffice with education or one of the minor portfolios? Do you think that Yamina are going to enter this coalition?
Well, you're asking me at a time when I know that the prime minister and Bennett are supposed to be meeting in just a couple hours. So I'll give you my prediction anyhow, even though people might listen to this after the meeting and then I'll sound like an idiot. But I think that there's two possibilities. On the one hand, Netanyahu would want them in the government because he always, if you look throughout the past 11 years that he's been prime minister, he's always had someone to the right of him. His objective has always been to be protected, have people on the right, as well as if, as long as he could, to have people on the left. Right. So originally he had Tzipi Livni, then he had Ehud Barak. He always had that because it gave him protection. He was able to be the guy, something in the middle and maneuver in that way. But he never wanted to have an opposition. The opposition could be left, but never someone who's more right wing than him in the opposition. I think that the reason is because Netanyahu always wanted to be the most right wing. Right. And when someone, even if they are more right wing than you, but they're in your government, you tame them a bit. You moderate them. They have to fall in line with you. Bennett might be tempted to go in. The opposition is no fun. It's, you know, you're a minister, a lot more leverage, a lot more influence. On the other hand, I think that Bennett is torn right now because he understands that if he does want to try to build himself up as an alternative, as a leader on the right, he does need to maybe sit some time in the opposition. If you think about it, he's been in the government since he entered politics in 2013. He's never sat in the opposition. And this might be the time for him to do that, especially considering the fact that his ability to really impact this government is going to be limited, right? You have really two big parties. Most of the portfolios are split between the two of them. The cabinet's going to be full of, two former chiefs of staff, Gantz and Ashkenazi, Likud ministers, more blue and white ministers. It'll be tough to really make a big impact, but we'll see what comes of their meeting. But those are the kind of the two different ideas or considerations that he's currently grappling with.
Is the issue over the portfolios? I mean, I take your point that kind of his influence generally is going to be limited because he's such a relatively small party, or a particularly small party in the coalition. But it is it also about portfolios? Can he accept? I mean, there's the old joke about general Israeli politics for Netanyahu governments, that he tries to find the cabinet portfolio for the least suitable person to weaken them and to expose them like that. Is that the case here, that he can be given kind of a golden chalice that isn't really is kind of more of a trap?
You know, Bennett had served as education minister for 3 years. He maybe even almost, 4 years. He has now been defense minister for 5-6 months. I don't think his dream is to go back to being education minister. So he might want to try to get himself a different portfolio if he were to go in. But overall, I really think that it's less about the portfolio. It's more about influence and really a longer term question of, where does he see himself in 3 years going into the next election? Where is he going to be as a politician? In what party? How is he going to present himself? If he again goes into this government, it's again, he's going to be overshadowed. And if he wants to build himself up as an alternative, I think there's a good argument to make that he should be doing that from the opposition.
If we can just ask a couple of issues, kind of, again, one of your other areas of expertise is obviously security issues. You're the author of a couple of books which relate to Israeli weapons technology and also the shadow war with Iran. This morning we woke up to revelations that Iran has successfully tested a military satellite into space for the first time. I know it's early days, but what's your initial assessment of how significant that is?
Look, a lot will depend on the type of satellite, what its capabilities are, and what it can see and what it can do, and the resolution and how high resolution. So there's a lot of questions in terms of Iran's ability to gather intelligence, right? That's number one. Number two, though, which I think is more important and should be a point of concern, is but we've known that they have this capability. If they can put a satellite in space, that pretty much means that they have the ability also to launch an intercontinental ballistic missile,
right?
You know, that would carry a nuclear warhead, and that is the real cause, I think, and the real part of the story that should concern anyone who's watching Iran right now. Iran, even with everything going on with the coronavirus, right? And by the way, they're officially talking about around 90,000 people infected. Here in Israel, military intelligence is saying that that's probably 5, 6, 7 times that number. But you see that even with all that going on, and they're really fighting hard against that virus, Javad Zarif, the foreign minister, was in Damascus the other day checking in on Bashar al-Assad. They're launching a military satellite into space. They're continuing with their nuclear program. This is a country that really has a clear ambition, and that is to get its hands on a nuclear weapon and potentially be able to use it one day. So I think what's most important from an Israeli perspective is, how do we ensure that the sanctions regime stays intact, definitely from the United States? And how do we keep the pressure on Iran? And hopefully, you know, the intelligence here is looking at Iran now in three different levels. They look at Iran from the stability of the regime and how the right virus might be affecting the stability. They look at it from the nuclear realm. How are they continuing with their enrichment of uranium? Is the IAEA keeping up its inspections and supervision? What in terms of quantity are they getting? What's happening to those secret nuclear sites that were revealed that the IAEA has openly admitted just a few weeks ago? They still have yet to get clear answers about, like, one of them, Turkuzabed, which was discovered by the Mossad. So then the third is the proxies, right? And we know that proxy war is still taking place. There was a mysterious airstrike against T4, the airbase near Homs, just 2 nights ago. There was that bombing, that part of it which caught on video, of a Jeep Cherokee which being driven by Hezbollah. Apparently, one of the occupants was Mustafa Mournia, the son of the slain Hezbollah commander Iman Mournia, who was killed in 2008 by the Mossad and the CIA. And they were in Syria, close to the border with Lebanon, apparently carrying components for Hezbollah's precision-guided missile program. And that Jeep was attacked. So there's a lot still going on. We might be all distracted by the virus, but this war, this covert shadow war, is still going on.
I wanted to ask you about that the strike on that jeep, which the footage is fascinating. Do you think it was that was part of the plan to send a message and a warning, or did on this occasion Israel miss their target?
First of all, Israel doesn't confirm or deny, so it's difficult to know. My guess would be that the initial missile missed its target, and then the second missile was the follow-up. That was the one that was caught on camera, right? So as you know, they were driving, a missile hit on the road, missed, the car pulled over. From that moment, it was caught on a nearby camera, and everyone jumped out. After about a minute, when they saw that the car wasn't being attacked again, they went back, grabbed their bags, ran away again, and then the car was actually hit by another missile. So it seems that, based on that, it seems that the car was, the initial original missile missed, second missile hit. But also keep in mind what happened just a day later. Right? That was on Thursday, Friday night. Hezbollah operatives come and cut three holes in the fence along the border between Israel and Lebanon, right? I mean, that's a clear escalation and very much shows the fact of what Hezbollah is willing to do, where they can go, how close they could get. This is a point of concern.
Yeah, big time. Yes, I was exactly going to ask you that as well. For all the high tech surveillance Israel has on the border, I think it's about 130 kilometers across the northern border on the blue line between Israel and Lebanon. It's incredible that Hezbollah were able, simultaneously on three points, to be able to break through, and just shows their capacity, their ability to do that undetected. I mean, that's my question is exactly how concerned should Israeli citizens, and especially citizens of the north, be about this? And how much do you think the mutual deterrence on both sides still holds?
Look, there's deterrence. There's deterrence because on the one hand, Hezbollah knows what Israel could potentially do to it. And they still haven't forgotten the results of the Second Lebanon War in 2006. But there's also deterrence of Israel by Hezbollah, by the fact that they have amassed such a huge, massive arsenal of rockets and missiles that can cover the entire state of Israel. All of this together is created this balance of deterrence. But even with deterrence, you need just a small little thing to set it off, right? As you know, Richard, Israel's attack does not attack in Lebanon. Any strikes it carries out are in Syria, right? Even if it wants to target someone from Hezbollah or some capability, it tries to get it in Syria before it moves into Lebanon. And that's because it knows that if it attacks in Lebanon, that would be viewed as an escalation that could potentially lead to a conflict. So there's that balance that always needs to be preserved, but a miscalculation, a mistake here, a mistake there could change everything.
Well, on that note, I mean, we will stay ever vigilant. Yaakov, thank you very much indeed for talking to us today. Really appreciate it. And for all our listeners, we hope you stay safe and get through this difficult period.
Thank you, Richard. You too. Thanks a lot.